You're listening to the She Lift Project podcast, a show dedicated to helping women achieve higher levels of success in the workplace. No matter where you are in your career, we want to help you grow. Now here's your host, Cynthia Kirkpatrick, a CPA, CFP, and senior financial advisor at Moneta Group.
Welcome to the She Lift Project podcast. I'm Cynthia Kirkpatrick. Thanks for joining us today. And I'm excited on many levels to share what we're going to share. We have Amy Post here, both amazing story and lots of information you're going to share, but also we're live. We have an audience. This is weird. And I'm excited to see where this goes because I've seen you do a podcast before. I've read so much about you and I'm just in awe of your story, and how you inspire and what you're going to share with us today. So I could read a lot. I'm going to try to really highlight and you go into what you want to go into in your bio. But first of all, I would say medical sales for 20 years, that would be good enough to talk about success, but you're married, you have two children, you are an author, which is why we're here. You've done podcasting, you have a nonprofit, you're helping people. I mean, what are you not doing?
It's a great question. Thank you for having me here. I'm just completely blessed to be here this evening and just talk about my book and the journey that we've been on. It's been amazing. So do you want me to kind of start at the beginning and why I wrote the book, or where would you prefer?
First of all, I saw you walk in earlier and I thought she's got it going on. She, you know, confident, successful, everything. I mean, in your own right, you are successful. You're in medical sales, 20 mm-hmm. years. Mm-hmm. Again, that could stand alone. So you're out there. I don't even know what that involves. I imagine working with doctors, working with hospital groups, selling stuff. And I'm sure you can explain it better than I am.
Yeah. So I've been in medical sales for 20 years. I started in veterinary sales and loved it. Just found some sort of spark. You know, I was great at it. And I don't think I've ever sold a day in my entire life. Never. I'm just good with people. And I love helping people. I love improving their business and really just digging in with them. So veterinary sales for several years. After that, I really launched myself into medical aesthetic sales. And I've called on plastic surgeons. I've worked at the OR. I've called on electrophysiologists, cardiologists, you name it. It's just what I did. And I love it.
So from animals to humans.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I guess in the end, we're all some type of animal. So yeah. It works. Makes sense. Yeah.
The first company I worked for, they had FDA approval for the veterinary side. I just kind of threw myself in and we were waiting for the human approval. And, you know, it didn't get there. But, you know, it's kind of where I've just found where I feel most comfortable.
So medical sales, again, a big part, but also a small part of what you're doing and why we're here today. Really, the book, one of the two things you're holding in your hands, launching mm-hmm. today.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have my book in my hand, which I love. I'm so glad just to be able to hold it and see it. It's real, finally. And then I have my journal. I take it with me everywhere. It's battered. It's bruised. It's something I write in all the time. And I really hold it near and dear to my heart because I can just jot things down that I'm feeling. And that's kind of how the book actually started.
Is it battered and bruised? Kind of like, I think life mm-hmm. treats us a little bit here and there.
Yeah.
So we talked before this started. One, I was like, wow, a book. You wrote a whole book by yourself. That's crazy, insane. And there's a lot of pages in there. Mm-hmm. And I think you said two things that were kind of funny, which you touched upon. One, accidental. And two, it's not for sissies, mm-hmm. which I love. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about, out of the gray and into the light. Let's talk about the book, why we're here. How was it an accident?
That's a great question. And I think that so many out there may hopefully resonate with those accidental things or things that they're just kind of thinking about. There was just a burning inside of me for several years. There had to be more. There was something that was just, I wasn't being fulfilled with something in my life. You know, things were great. Everybody could look at your life and say you have, you know, a very, very nice life. You know, I was married, two great children, great job, but there's always been something else really kind of burning. And I think when the book really ignited, it was one of those points where I was taken to a complete surrender location. And God just kind of found me in this area of like uncertainty, loneliness, despair, fear. And that's never been anything that I've ever known. And so when my life really came to that point, I knew what I needed to do. And I remember calling one of my friends in Austin, Texas, and asking him to give me some publishers and some information that I just felt God needs me to write a book. Maybe I'm crazy. I don't know what's going on. I am veering completely outside my comfort zone, but I have to do this because one, I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat, I couldn't function. Something really terrifying was happening. But I think now I look back and it was extremely exciting because it was what I was being led to do and I just wasn't listening well enough.
That's a theme, I think, in life, right? We really need to listen, pause. Mm-hmm. As you said, you stopped, you surrendered, pause instead of go, 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 yeah. And really sit back and yeah. listen.
Yeah.
I'm sure that was hard to do with as much as you have going on in your life.
It was really hard. And I think for women in general, too, you know, we have so much on our shoulders. There are so many things that we feel we need to do or we have to do. I'm one of them. I fall prey to it all of the time. You know, if I do this, if I just do more, if I just do more of this, just faster, better, more, you know. And so it was a situation where I had to sit back after many nights and days of just being, I think, tormented almost. And that's how I felt because I didn't understand why I was being taken back 8.5 years through some very traumatic situations. I had put it under the rug. It was over. We had gone through it and it was over. It wasn't. And so once I really realized that, I needed some clarification.
Why do you think it wasn't over? You talked about how you write everything in your book and it's a release mm-hmm. and you get it out. Did you really get it out?
So I've journaled probably 100 and some pages and I realized that this was the start of the book and my journaling 8.5 years ago when our situation began was the beginning of the book. I just didn't realize it. And so it was just a cool perspective to be able to look back and see where it actually began, but I just didn't realize it.
So 8.5 years is very important, but I also did, as I had to do research ahead of time as much as I could, and I know a little bit more about you, your struggles and your life and who you are today really starts in your youth. Before the spouse and the career and the kids mm-hmm. and everything, your childhood, mm-hmm. I would imagine, really helped form you into who you are today, maybe even helping you overcome what you had to overcome. Mm-hmm. Not many people would get through that. And not only would they not get through it, but they would not get through it to the positive side.
Yeah, I think that we all have to look at the different situations. My childhood was tough. You know, growing up, I was kind of shown a perspective of if you are bad, you do bad things, you get rewarded. And if you're good, you don't get rewarded. And so for me, it was a very backwards situation of looking at my life, but it took many years of really kind of re-looking at it and digging at it and looking at it again. And I don't have a relationship with my mother. I don't even know actually who she is. I love her very much. Love my parents very much, love my family. But I think with looking back in my childhood, my parents did what they thought was best. My brother was a heroin addict. He was a methamphetamine addict. And anything that he did seemed to be rewarded with, if you just stop doing all of this, you will be rewarded with anything that you want. Full college tuition, houses, cars, clothes, anything. And, you know, if you're an enabler, it's very difficult to see the situation. But yet, if you're called out as an enabler, it's a very difficult position. And I think that when I realized in my early, my early years, I mean, I think I was 15, 14 when my brother started doing drugs. And I realized very soon, you know, what my parents were doing. It was that, you know, enabling him to be the person that he was and not being seen, not being valued. It's not to say that I wasn't loved. I think that they loved me very much. They loved me in the way that they could. It's just I didn't see myself as being valued. Nothing that I said was actually seen or taken, you know, with anything more than, you know, it's not true. It's not happening. But if I was good, I didn't get what he received. But I made a really big vow in my life that I would always be true to myself. And I knew what I needed to do, and I needed to be the person that I wanted to be. I've always been a very giving individual, extremely passionate. I started owning businesses at age 15. And I think having the childhood that I did, it also gave me the ability to see what I didn't want to be in life and what I did. And I wanted to be able to kind of escape that. But I also fell into, I wanted to prove myself to everyone, especially my parents, my family. And then it ended up escalating to my life of just wanting to prove myself to people that I was something, that I could be valued, that I could be loved. And that was huge for me.
So value and love from the outside versus maybe part of your journey, finding that value and love from the inside first.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I wonder if that's partly, again, this is all your story, but I think being female, I connect with being that good girl.
Mm-hmm.
So if you put the smile on, if you put the mask on, you cover yourself and you're what everybody else needs you to be and you're the good girl, eventually, just keep doing it. Just yeah. keep giving to everybody else, because eventually you'll get noticed and eventually you get that reward, what you yeah. deserve.
Yeah.
And I'm sure being second of two kids, that's also can be, bring its own, you know, childhood level of yeah. I'm not the firstborn, I'm not yeah. the boy, maybe. That also, mm-hmm. hey, I'm second and I'm truly being treated as second.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think I look back now and I value what I received and I value how I look at it, because it's really, it's formed who I am. I have a really strong, you know, external skin. And I think I've, you know, there's positives and negatives in all of that. But I do believe that, you know, through all of, you know, the trauma and the situations that I've been through, I learned at a very young age, it's okay. Just be yourself. And I think through that perseverance, just kind of creating who I wanted to be. But I still look back and see those situations as, you know, clear as day, like it was yesterday, of just not being accepted, not being valued, not being seen.
Because as you said, you had the great grades, mm-hmm. you worked. I mean, shoot, you even started your own or took over a company, I think was it 18 or so?
Yeah, so I started a business for Wayne Newton at age 15. And those who have absolutely no idea who Wayne Newton is, he's kind of that Vegas guy. And he bought my parents home and land in the Ozarks. And I just created a business. And so from that point on, I realized that I had something. And then at age 18, I went to my parents and asked if I could buy the tanning salon that I worked at. I hadn't worked there too long, but the owners, you know, brought it up to the employees being for sale. And my dad said, we'll consider it. My mom said, absolutely not. Absolutely not. But I had been seeing my brother being given everything, but there was nothing for me. So I went back to my dad and he said, yep, we're going to give you this. My mother said, oh, but not without a really stern interest rate and amortization. And I paid them back. And they said, you know, if you can pay us back in like, you know, 5 or 6 years. And I said, I'll pay you back in 4. And I did. And I think it was just to prove to my mother that I was valuable and that there was value within what I was doing and who I was. But I always searched for that value. And I see it much more clearly now that I've had the ability to write this book. Like I said, I journal everything and I look back through it all, but being able to really kind of write it and then look back through it has been huge.
I'm going to go back to the Wayne Newton story because that sounds fun and interesting. And I am horrible at remembering names and what people look like. But if I have this right, like the dark black mm-hmm. hair, yes. that's like, and yeah. you know, in the Ozarks, there's all these yeah. shows and things mm-hmm. around that people yeah. go to. So those kind of celebrities, I think my mom would remember better. Yes. They bought the land, bought it mm-hmm. and was building a business and you become a part of that. What?
Yeah, so I went to him when he purchased the land and said, I would love to do your landscaping, your mowing. What can I do for you? I would just love to do something. I loved the property so much. I was really heartbroken when my parents sold it. It was actually a partnership between them and a physician. And he said, sure, what would you like to do? And that's kind of where it catapulted. And he was phenomenal. And from age 15, I realized I had something. I really, really did. He was kind of that individual that mentored me. I saw him each time that I would, you know, be on the property and be able to, you know, mow and do landscaping. My father helped me buy a lawnmower. And he helped me until I was able to be 16 and be able to get my own trailer and be able to travel and do it. And so my father was sort of that individual that really helped me. But also with Wayne Newton, it was just that person who believed in me. You know, he's like, I'll give you a shot. What do you want? What do you need? And so it was just, it was a turning point.
Sounds like maybe one of the first or most pivotal memories of somebody mm-hmm. believing in you.
Yeah.
Someone else other mm-hmm. than you believing in you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And then when I bought the tanning salon, when my dad did believe in me, it was huge. And I did. I paid him back in 4 years. I made a very successful business. I catapulted two businesses out of it. And it was great. I just realized that, you know, I had a calling.
I mean, that's pretty successful already. And I'm thinking, and here she is struggling with feeling her own value and worth mm-hmm. and looking for it elsewhere. And I know you mm-hmm. mentioned your mom. I'm sure we'll come back to it at some point, but maybe it's just now that you say still don't know her. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like you meant that in a different way than I don't talk to her. I don't know where she lives. I just don't know her.
Yeah. You know, I think a daughter always wants, you know, something from both of their parents. But, you know, I always wanted to know my mother. I always wanted to have that deeper level. I wanted to get underneath the hood. I really wanted to see, you know, what made her tick, how she grew up. And it was just not allowed. It just wasn't. So I then realized that in order to spend time with her and get to know her, I would clean the house with her. I would do the landscaping. I would do the mowing. I would do whatever I could to just be around her and just get to know her. And so I think for me, it was a positive and a negative thing to just not be able to have what I wanted, but yet be able to just spend some time with her. I'd love to know her on a different level, and I've always told her that. Maybe it's not always accepted, but you know, I want to know people on a deeper level. I'm not that individual that just wants these surface level relationships. I want to get underneath the hood. I want to know what makes you tick. I want to hear your story. I want to really dig deep, and I want to care and love those individuals. And my mom has just not given me that opportunity.
And it sounds like a theme in your life as we go through the rest of it that you could have, and maybe a lot of people would have been like, you know, fine, mom, you don't care about me. I'm not going to re-engage. But instead, you got creative and thought, how can I come back into it and get, yeah. as you said, deeper mm-hmm. and at least try and yeah. not give up?
Yeah. Yep, I did. I always did, you know, and it has brought us to a better relationship. It's not a deep relationship like I would like, but it's a good relationship.
And we're going to move on, but thinking back to those early years, everybody's probably been asked the question, would you change it? Anything?
I wouldn't. You know, I wouldn't. I think everything happens for a reason. I wouldn't change anything. I think that there are just certain things in my life that happened with my brother, especially, that I wish that I could have changed. And I wish that I could have changed, you know, my parents' thought process of how they dealt with it. But yet, it wasn't my doing. It wasn't my story. It was, you know, theirs with him. And, you know, I created my own life. And I think I am that person because of what I've persevered through and kind of the things that I had to move through at a very early age and kind of seeing what he went through.
How did you persevere? What was it in you? A lot of people would crumble. A lot of people would fall victim to the same things. But you clearly overcame in so many ways. What is it?
I didn't want to be that person. I didn't want to be that individual that received something for being bad. I always saw the good in people. I remember for the longest time, and I had an individual in my life that made fun of me for being happy all the time. And then many people were like, how can she be happy all the time? I don't understand it. She's so happy. It was just who I was, you know, growing up. And there was nothing that was going to turn me to be bad. And I remember at a young age making a list, and I don't know if anybody's ever done this, but positives and negatives of what I do want to take with me in the future and what I don't want to take with me. And I remember it very clearly. I can remember writing it to this day. And what I didn't want to take with me was much longer than what I did want to take with me. And I remember realizing that I just needed to go my own way. And it was just what it is. You know, I had to go my own way.
I don't say too many people probably at a young age would recall writing a list like that. So I think we're seeing the themes in your life of, you know, early, beyond your years thinking yeah. and power and strength that you probably didn't really realize you had mm-hmm. at that time. But we take from the, you know, again, at 18, taking over the tanning salon, you grew that for many years, mm-hmm. sold that. Mm-hmm. And that was a pretty pivotal time, if I remember right. I mean, from there, where did you go? What did you do?
Yeah, so I moved to St. Louis. I was living in Springfield, Missouri. I moved to St. Louis, and I didn't know but two people in St. Louis. And I remember walking across the campus at Missouri State University and just knocking on doors and asking, how can I get involved? What's going on? What can I do? And that then catapulted me into a huge opportunity of being able to travel to Europe. I had a full scholarship to go to business school in Europe, but it also allowed me to catapult a international business organization. And I was president, and probably one of the best things that I've ever done in my entire life, because one, the professor taught me how to delegate. My mother never taught me how to delegate. Her words were, if you want something done, do it yourself. And this woman, her name was Betty Vining. She said, you need to learn how to delegate, Ms. Post. You need to learn how to ask for help and delegate. And that was just extremely foreign to me. She taught me just about everything I know, poured myself into marketing, business, international, and that was kind of all she wrote. And then when I went to Europe and traveled across Europe for business school, it was just an incredible opportunity to be able to just kind of find myself and find who I felt that God needed me to be, even though I didn't have a huge faith at that point. My faith earlier on, and as you'll read in the book, it was different. I couldn't really put my finger on it, but I think it was wavering. So that trip and that opportunity and being able to go to business school there, it really molded me into the person that I am, because I needed to take that leap. I needed to lean into something that made me so uncomfortable. I couldn't figure out why it made me uncomfortable. But I look back and know that everything that I've ever done in life has always made me uncomfortable. And I lean into it because it makes me so curious to know why it makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah, most people would lean away or mm-hmm. run away, maybe. But yeah. Here you are. Not very far into your life, really, and leaning into everything.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just what I felt I needed to do. I'm never going to be the smartest person in the room. Always want to just create that room where, you know, everybody else is smarter so I can learn from them. And I've always been that humble individual that I just want to learn from everyone, and I want constructive criticism, but I will lean into anything that makes me uncomfortable. And I press people now, just if anything makes you uncomfortable, lean into it, because there's something there. There's a spark. There's something at the other side that is just going to be that pearl that you need to find. And if you don't do it, I think you're going to regret it for a long time.
So counter to what we try to teach our kids, some of us, how we raise our kids, right? To not feel pain, not be uncomfortable, take everything away. It almost makes me nervous about what the world's going to be like in 10, 20 years, that the pain is unfortunately important. And maybe that propeller that pulls us back a little bit to the beginning, but gets us further than we would have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can tell anybody, just lean into those uncomfortable times. Absolutely do. Figure it out what it is that makes you uncomfortable. If everybody goes right, just go left. You will blaze the trails and make your own destiny that will be something that you've never been able to imagine. But you never know until you lean into it. And why wouldn't you want to?
You go from the Ozarks to St. Louis knowing two people, probably being asked a million times where you went to high school, and it didn't make any sense to you.
It was so annoying.
And then going to Europe, my gosh, how did you get back, or what brought you back, or what was your journey?
Yeah, so, you know, coming back, it was just a great opportunity to come back. I graduated and really didn't know exactly what I wanted to do at the time. So I took, you know, several different steps, took different jobs, then moved to Florida, came back to St. Louis. It was just kind of, you know, one of those things. And then, you know, one day, one of my girlfriends said, you know, you need to go to the gym at 5 p.m. And I said, I don't go to the gym at 5 p.m. I go at 5 a.m. And she said, well, if you're going to meet anybody, you have to go at 5 p.m. I said, who on earth am I going to meet at 5 p.m.? Because I don't go. I don't do that kind of thing. So the first night that I went, I saw this guy. Makes me teary-eyed. There was some sort of safety in his eyes, in his smile, that I couldn't look away. And I wasn't that person. I was not looking for anybody. I don't do that. I have a wall up so hard you can't get into it. You can't get past it. You can't get over it.
Because you had been in a relationship for a long time before then that had ended. So yeah, you really walled up.
Mm-hmm. I did. I really did. And so this was just something that God has a plan. I can look back now and know that God has a plan for everything. And I can see it so beautifully, what I couldn't see then. And I think that more people need to lean into that. But it wasn't, it was a little bit of a bumpy ride with him in the beginning. I think his self-esteem was a little uncertain, and that was okay.
I think the way he told me before we started this tonight was that I think he asked you for your number to go out first, and you said no, and then it came around again. So
Yeah, and I, you know, when I went to the gym, and I, you know, I don't go to the gym too much. We have a gym in our house now, but I'd wear that ball cap down. Do not look at me. Do not talk to me. I'm running for an hour on the treadmill. I am working out. Please just don't bother me. That was just my, I'm sure it was my really harsh, you know, aura that I gave off.
And yet here he was willing to try to poke through that, break through that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. He was with a friend. I don't think I even saw the friend. I was like, you know, I just saw him. That was it.
So take me to that moment. Like, literally, you're in ball cap. I mean, do you see him? He sees you first. Mm-hmm. He bothers you first. And you're like, don't talk to me. What was it?
Honestly, it was, we just kept looking at each other and looking at each other. And I think then I kept going back at 5 p.m. Gosh. Told myself I'd never go at 5 p.m.
Lean into, you know, the uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So that was, you know, we'd see each other. And I remember being on the treadmill, and I remember him being behind me several times. I'm like, if I fall off this thing, he's going to have it. I'm going to knock him over back into the wall. And so, it was just very, very uncomfortable. But I think, we just started talking. It was nice. It was something extremely different than I had had before. And it was uncomfortable. And I did have to lean into it.
Well, it's interesting that you said there was a safety in his eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And, through your story so far and more to come, that's really what you were needing and looking for.
Yeah.
Was someone else in your life to be there and maybe even be a little bit of a protector or be that person that every now and then you just knew you were safe with.
Yeah. And that person that just accepted me who I was. If you can accept me at the gym sweating, and believe me, it was probably not overly pretty. And I don't smell well when I'm at the gym. So if that can be one of those things that, that individual likes you for, keep them, grab them, keep them for life. They're a keeper. They're like, I can see you in a ball cap and sweating and I don't care how smelly you are. And it's okay. And he's like, I didn't even know you were smelling. I'm like, I couldn't even stand myself,
Might want to check his olfactory nerves, make sure those are still kicking. Although I think sometimes guys just see, what they see and all those other senses. They can only do one sense at a time sometimes, I think.
Yeah.
That's good, whether personally or in business, I think, or any part of your life, whether you're, no matter your age or gender, to be you and surround yourself with the people that will support that, protect it, cherish it. And you can truly be your full self with. Mm-hmm. That's an important life lesson.
Yeah, it is.
So the young ones that are here, make sure you find those people who want you around as your true self. So you meet him, and obviously kids and marriage later, because he's in the room. Yes. It worked out.
Yeah, it worked out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was good.
So what next? And you know what? Before I go there, because he also shared with me ahead of time that you are both not from St. Louis. You're both from another town and you met here. So if we want to add to even more of the lore of the story that it was meant to be, this share. You're both not from here. You're both from a similar place.
Yep. So I may embarrass him when I say this, but he has actually told me, which I totally appreciate because I didn't know, was that he saw me when we lived in Springfield at the gym. I just never saw him. Very focused. I mean, it was who I was. And so I think after he brought that to my attention, I realized, I was that person. It's like nobody could get close to me. Nobody could touch me. Nobody could just get in. And I was like, I don't remember you. But it wasn't against him. It was against myself. I just didn't let people in. I didn't want it. It just wasn't where I needed to be. I was in a lot of turmoil with my family and my brother and just life. Things like that. So when he did tell me that, he's like, I saw you. But then his comment of, I don't think you would have liked me. I think everything does happen for a reason. We go through life, maybe we're not who we wanted to be at a certain point, and things just kind of merge and life just works out. And that's what I think our love story was totally about. I was just in that situation where I, didn't see him. I didn't see anybody. I didn't want to see anybody. And so I saw him when it was ready.
Right time, right place. But I think, again, another important life lesson and something I've learned about myself is it feels the right thing to do and safe to build that wall to protect yourself, not let the hurt in. But when you build that wall, nothing else can get in. So if you build a wall to keep the dark out, you're also keeping the light out.
Yes.
And so that love, that safety, that pureness also can't get in.
Absolutely. And I didn't see it at the time. And writing the book, and I can honestly say, I'm going to say it a million times, writing the book was the best thing that ever happened to me, to be able to see so many things in a different light and a different perspective than I never saw before. And I'm so grateful and blessed for that opportunity and humble that I was able to do this.
So you just need that wrecking ball to come in and
tear
absolutely. The whole freaking thing apart.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So we fast forward. So you guys clearly are together.
Yeah.
Still. And, you know, we get closer to the point of the book. You know, you have children, mm-hmm. right? And you have your son first. Mm-hmm. Probably, and what I heard you say before is, maybe I should ask, how was that growing up, how you grew up in the family that you grew up with? And then here you are married and your first child.
Yeah, that's a loaded question.
I kind of knew that going in.
I knew what I didn't want, and I knew what I absolutely did want. I had so many goals and aspirations. We both did, you know, being able to raise our first child. But I had a lot of fears of, oh my gosh, what if they turn out like my brother? And then I had another situation where we didn't talk about it. But I helped my mother raise my nephew for 6 years. And my nephew was my brother's second of 5 or 6 kids. And I loved him dearly, absolutely loved him dearly. And my husband was on board. We'd have, you know, my nephew come visit us all the time. I just really, really needed to have him around. And I saw something in him that just wasn't looking good. You know, maybe just following a lifestyle that my brother led, that I really wanted him to know that there was something else there. He was loved, he was valued. All the things that I think I needed, I think I just needed to pour into him, and we did. And my husband and I had a conversation one day, and I came to him and said, I want to adopt my nephew. I want to adopt Alton. And I remember talking about it for, gosh, weeks, if not maybe months. And coming to him and offering him to be, you know, a part of our family, to come live with us. I'm still waiting till today for that call back, that answer. So my upbringing was just very uncertain. It was just, I just wanted, you can see kind of where I just needed to be valued. I just needed that. I just wanted to help people. I wanted to save them. I think I realized that about myself a really long time ago. And my husband was great at, you know, being able to talk through that. And he was so gracious in offering that for my nephew and understanding kind of where I came from. But yeah, things were good. Our life was really great. From the outside looking in, everything was wonderful. I think I always just had this burning of what next. Like there was always something inside of me that just never felt settled. I don't know exactly what it was. I think part of it was from my family, of just never feeling. I wanted more from them. I wanted to have this relationship that I just couldn't have. And I think I've always had this unsettled feeling within me. And I think my husband felt it for a really long time. So that was difficult for us, you know, even having our first child.
You almost wonder if it's that thing of, well, okay, if they're not going to connect with me on this, I'll do the next thing. And will that be good enough? And I'll do the next thing, and maybe that will be good enough. And I'm going to keep going until, you know, I run myself into the ground trying to please others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's, once I look back now, it's kind of how I see things. I didn't see it the same way then. I see it much more clear now, out of the gray into the light. A lot of different aspects.
So now we're going to really get into even more heavier stuff, probably a lot of what's spurred on the book. But then you have another, you said, we love this, having a child. Yeah. You forget what it's like having your first. You're like, yes, let's have another. We have three. I love them all. So you have a couple years later, you have your daughter.
Yeah, so it was so traumatic having my son. I told my husband I will never have another child.
What was traumatic about it? Was there something physically with the pregnancy and delivery that went wrong? Was it what you were talking about going back to your childhood?
No, I think it was just me. It was just me. I remember so many years ago telling myself I never wanted to get married and I never wanted to have children. And it was just that wall, that really protective wall around me of what are you scared of? There are so many things. But once we had our son, it was wonderful. But I think I was fighting demons that we all fight. And we're just trying to figure out, you know, who am I? Like, what do I want?
Well, it doesn't help that you're hormonal and your body went through all this, just made a human being and brought it into this world, that you're, you know, going through all of that on top of it.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, having our son was phenomenal. I mean, I spent every moment with him. I mean, I remember being able to spend so much time with him. It was ridiculous. I mean, we had so much fun. And so he was the light of my life and it was wonderful. And then all of a sudden, I think I just realized, you know, I would like a girl. You know, let's just kind of try to figure this out.
So you just ordered one up.
Just ordered one up.
That's how it works. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have a girl. Here we go.
And it's really funny. I do have to tell you, and Eric will probably laugh at this in the audience, when we were there for the ultrasound with our son, she's like, it's a girl. He said, no, you need to keep looking. There's laughing. I hear you.
Control much?
And I'm sitting there. I have to go to the bathroom so bad. They didn't let me pee for like 3 hours. I'm literally dying, laying on the table. If any women are out there, you're like, I get it. I know. And he's like, no, you have to keep looking. I'm like, I just have to go to the bathroom. Like, she's told us it's a girl. Like, stop. And so he's like, no, you have to keep looking. It's not a girl. She goes, it's a boy. I was like, wow, you know, this is just crazy. So I don't know if I was more scared to have a girl or a boy. I think I was just scared. But, you know, once he said that, it was just kind of like, wow, how did you know that? You know, because it wouldn't have been my instinct to know that. But it was one of those comical kind of funny things.
So it sounds like it worked out because then you decided or forgot and you how much you went through, and as we a lot of us do, and you had a second.
Yes.
You're a little girl.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
As by that point, you're probably the pro, right? So no concerns, no worries. Second time around, we're good?
Yep, we're good.
Mm-hmm. Career's going well. Everything going well.
Yeah, you know, my sales career has always gone well. I've always been at the top of my company, you know, President Club, Rookie of the Year awards. I mean, everything is good, but there's still something just always burning. There was always something inside of me, and I couldn't put my finger on it. I envied those that could have that, like, calmness about them and feel as though they just were kind of where they needed to be. And so I think that unsettled feeling just always stirred me. And so when we decided to have, you know, another child, it was great, and found out that it was a girl, it was phenomenal. And the first, you know, 3 years were great. Everything was wonderful. I'm a very simple individual. I just, you know, want to spend time with family and do things outdoors. Outdoors is kind of my getaway. It's kind of where I find God. In nature and being able to just really connect. And that's where I really loved kind of bringing my children and my husband. It was too funny because I think we're very, very different. You know, he's kind of that sports fanatic. I have absolutely no idea of any even sports teams on earth. No idea.
But let's be fair. When you say you're an outdoors person, this isn't like I'm going to the park around the corner and I'm walking. It's kayaking, hiking, running, biking. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is an elevated.
Yeah, I'm a little bit extreme.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he had to kind of find out of my extremities, which, you know, baptism by fire.
Best way to go. So, and I don't want to put the words in the mouth, but, you know, as you said, 3 years, mm-hmm. things were going pretty well. And I think a lot of where at 3 years starts mm-hmm. a lot of learning and fear and worry and experience and everything, any emotion you can think of, it starts at that moment.
Yeah. So our daughter had sporadic temperatures for 6 months. And when they started, it was a little uncertainty, a little worry, and then it just sped up to a great amount of fear. And our pediatrician kept telling us, there's nothing wrong, nothing happening, she's fine. We took her in almost every week and or we called several times a week. That was huge. And it was one of those situations where I just felt something was happening. And then it occurred one day when we received a phone call from her daycare. And they said, you know, Madison has sat down on the playground. She's not feeling well. She just sat down. She doesn't want to play. And I remember my mother instincts just really kind of kicking in. My stomach just fell into the bottoms of my feet. And I felt that something was wrong. We picked her up from school. She was in daycare. She was three, and we kept her home the next day, and I just couldn't let her out of my sight. And she just had these sporadic temperatures, stomach aches, didn't feel good, and on Sunday had tremendous stomach aches, just bellowing over, and she spiked about 104 temperature. My husband took her to a nearby hospital. It was an adult hospital, just, it was, you know, I think it was maybe 7 or 8 p.m. on a Sunday evening, and he woke me up that next morning at 5. I was supposed to leave on a sales meeting to California, and I had had stomach aches that evening and thought she and I just, you know, ate something wrong, something's just not right. And he woke me up at 5 and said, we have to get to the hospital very quickly. I didn't want to wake you. The doctor called at 3:30 and said, we need to get to Children's immediately. Something is wrong. So I put Zachary on the bus and my husband took Madison to the hospital. And we waited in rooms for, it seemed like, all day. The white rooms, just these blocks. And a person can go insane being in those rooms. And the physician came in and he was just white as a sheet and said, I'm so sorry to tell you this, but your daughter has malignant liver cancer. It's hepatoblastoma of the liver and it's stage 3, stage 4 hepatoblastoma. And we've got a room ready for her. We have chemotherapy already. We have transfusions ready. She's going to need a liver transplant and you have to get up there immediately. And I had my purse and the clothes on my back. And we were whisked into the healthcare system. And that's when those moments just flushed through me that our life had forever changed.
Yeah, and through your story and her care, because you also had some health issues, you had to do a lot of learning.
Yeah.
Maybe unlearning the traditional medical system, learning new things. But I think a big part of your journey was fighting for both of you and pushing back and asking why. You know, as you said, you see these doctors in their lab coats and we're told, and we see it on TV, these are the smartest of the smartest people, right? And they know everything. And we should take what they tell us for gospel. Yet your journey was a lot of No. And push back and push back. And why?
Yeah.
Why are you telling us to do this? Why is this going to work? I mean, again, it's not my story, yours, but I think that's so important for people to learn that sometimes you have to take it in control and step up and learn and advocate and push and ask why.
Yeah, I think this is where my warrior came out. I think my true self was actually able to be released at those moments when I knew it just, I had to do it. But I think the healthcare system is, it's very broken. And we learned very quickly that to survive there, you really need to figure it out yourself quickly. And that's what we did. But it wasn't without a lot of sacrifice and a lot of difficult times and a lot of punches in the stomach. It was very, very difficult. But God entered my life and I think allowed me to give that ability to advocate for myself and for my daughter and advocate for everyone else there. Because we saw protocols, we saw things that weren't right. And I knew hands down they weren't right. One, being in the medical industry for 20 years, I knew doctors were given way too much credit. I'm not saying they aren't smart, but they're smart in their specialty. You don't give them credit for everything that physicians know across the board. And unfortunately, people just have a blanket, I think, understanding, and they want to believe. They desperately want to believe that somebody knows. But I think entering that healthcare system allowed me to push back and really change protocols. I wasn't exactly sure what I should put in the book, and it was really tough to kind of know, but we changed a lot of protocols, we changed a lot of rules, and hopefully we changed a lot of minds within that hospital, because when we would go back in, things were changed.
And you would go back in and they would see you're better, you and your daughter, you're better, you're doing these different things. And again, you could have just gone home, kept doing those and been better, but you go back and you say, this is what I'm doing. These things need to be changed. That takes energy and time.
Yeah, and I didn't have any energy whatsoever. I don't think I slept a moment. My daughter went under 70-some procedures under anesthesia within 12 months. She had 6 rounds of chemotherapy. She had a full liver transplant. And she was then diagnosed with a rare genetic cancer gene that would bring and diagnose 2 additional cancers. I spent my evenings completely researching all night long, and I still worked. I still worked in the aesthetic medical arena, begging my accounts not to give up on me and to please just have faith that I would be back. But yet, my daughter and I were in for 4 weeks every time. We were not allowed to leave the hospital. And we would be allowed 24 to 48 hours each time we would go home. And it was very, very difficult in the beginning, because we would go home and it would be like, okay, we're here, but now what? Like, I don't even know who I am. I lost my identity. I have no idea what's going on. I'm completely and utterly lost. I don't even know what they're talking about. We weren't really given the information that we needed. And then 24 to 48 hours later, we were whisked right back again for another month. And then it would happen over and over and over and over again for a couple of years. And so it was a situation where I then knew that the hospital was our home. I remember coming home and thinking, I'm allowed to come here to my safe place for a little bit of time. And God has given me this ability to recharge. And then we go back and fight again. And we go back and advocate. And I remember that thinking that was the craziest thing, that something had ever popped into my head. And now I see it so clearly. It was just this opportunity to advocate, but knowing that we just get that re-energized opportunity at home for a little amount of time, and then we go back again.
Well, and that's got to be difficult both with your husband and your son, right? And you guys are gone for 4 weeks. I mean, I think sometimes we think, you know, when the spouse is gone for a day or two, you're in the groove. You got it going on. You know what you have to take care of. Yeah. And then they come back and you're like, oh, everything's disrupted again. I'm sure that was very difficult to re-enter that space and knowing they're leaving again and the uncertainty, all of it. I'm sure that had to be hard on all four of you.
Yeah, it did. You know, and my husband had our son at home. And so they lived their lives and we lived ours. I had a lot of anger, I think, just not understanding, you know, that he didn't understand what we were going through. It was never a moment of rest or peace. It was just completely, when you didn't think that the floor could fall out again, it did, over and over and over. And I think I couldn't understand why he wasn't on the same page as me. And I think that a lot of couples really, they land themselves there. I remember that the first day after going into the hospital, we found out that 90% of the couples get divorced. And the woman said to me, you know, Amy, you have to understand, children die and 90% of these couples get divorced. So you just need to prepare yourself. And I thought, oh my gosh, how are we going to do this? How are we going to get out? But not 30 minutes before that, 5 a.m., my kind of alarm went off in my head. Got up. Madison was still sleeping. It was the first day that we had just woke up in this place that we didn't understand what was happening. And I walked across the hallway into the coffee room, and there was a gentleman in there. And I remember asking him why he was in, just like we're like in some jail, you know, some prison cell. It's because I felt that way with these little walls. He said our son was diagnosed around age 4 with cancer. And I remember just my heart falling. He said, you know, he was in remission for quite some time, but now we're back. He has brain cancer. He's 13. And I remember thinking, I have nothing to feel bad about. I have to be grateful every single day. I have to count my blessings. And I have to find something to be grateful for every day, because I don't know how we're going to make it out of here if I don't. And that's when a new routine just started. It was that first day. It was that moment. It was that trajectory that just pushed me forward to know that we had to count our blessings.
How'd you do it? Because there's probably a lot of us thinking, wow, I thought I had it hard. And a lot of days I think, how am I going to get through this? How'd you do that?
It wasn't easy, but you know, some people would say, you know, you were in denial, or sure, everybody's in some sort of denial, no matter what. Maybe I was, but I think it was that positivity and just knowing that we had to be able to get out of here. But I didn't, everybody went right. I was going to go left. And how are we going to do that? I couldn't find God a lot of days, and I wanted to just crawl into that little corner of the room and just cry. But I couldn't, because one, my perspective, my attitude, and my behavior around my daughter just needed to be completely positive, because she fed off of everything that I felt. So there were a lot of things that really just came into line, and I don't know how I did it. It's just I remember that day like it was yesterday. And there wasn't going to be a moment that didn't offer me opportunity to say my prayers and be grateful for something in life. Because I knew that my mind frame had to be positive for us to get out of here. Had to be positive to be able to figure out what was next. I wasn't trusting everything that the hospital was telling us. It just didn't feel right. The hair on the back of my neck stood up. My intuitions just weren't right.
You know? And by that, you guys looked into a lot of different things.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember, you know, essential oils, different therapies, what you were eating and ingesting. It was a lot, like even going to the hospital and saying, you changed your food at the hospital.
Yeah.
This won't work.
Yeah, I remember an encounter the first evening with a nutritionist, and it wasn't a positive one. I'm surprised I wasn't thrown out of the hospital several times. But I'm sorry, if you have a nutritionist in the hospital, they maybe need to look a certain way. Maybe need to speak healthy, look healthy, do something healthy. We had found out that several months before, the hospital had canceled their contracts with some different facilities that brought in healthier food, fruits and vegetables, and the nurses were very upset. They were livid. How are they supposed to have a productive day and be productive for patients when they're fed, you know, fried foods and pizza and processed foods and things that are just not going to be healthy for them? And so my encounter with the nutritionist was not good. And then the call to the director of the hospital, and it went up from there to numerous meetings with the directors of every single facility in that entire hospital every single month to talk about things that I wanted to change. And I was a mother. I was nobody. I was just a mother fighting for her daughter and wanting to be able to change things.
Wanting to fight to make a positive difference and a positive change.
Yeah.
Do you think you would have been able to do that without growing up how you grew up?
No, I don't. No.
seems like you, the training of being a fighter and a scrapper, mm-hmm. and overcoming that training ground, you really needed to pull up in order to be successful.
Yeah. I've always been the underdog, and it's okay. I love the underdogs. Like, they're the ones that just see life in a different way, and they get to experience it in a different way, and they have this respect for life and this look and this value they don't get. And maybe, you know, the value that I was looking for was just always there. I just hadn't seen it yet. And so this opportunity, I think, with my daughter and what we went through allowed me to do that. But it was cool in another way, because there were really cool opportunities for me to speak with other families. And that was very foreign. I was asked to just give them encouragement, just talk to them, just let them know, you know, it's going to be okay. And I remember that first time that I was supposed to talk to a woman and her child that came in. She had cancer. My daughter and I were just getting out at 4 weeks in. And I remember her stopping us at the room and just saying, I need you to encourage her. She is just absolutely unconsolable. Her daughter has cancer. Her daughter is 4. And I need you to just let her know it's going to be okay. How am I supposed to let her know it's going to be okay? We have just been given, you know, this invitation to the valley of death, and we don't know what's going to happen to you. And, you know, we have bad luck, and it's really, really fearful. And I remember my daughter and I are walking to the elevator, and the woman is on the left, and I can see her just crying, and I see her daughter in the bed. The elevators are on the right, and we can run. Like, we don't have to stop. We can go. Like, Madison's just like tugging on me, just tugging. I walk left. I walk into the room, and I don't remember exactly what I said to her, but I just let her know it was going to be okay. You have to have hope. You have to have faith. You have to advocate. If nothing more, you have to advocate for what you want. You have to push back. You have to ask questions. What they want you to do in here is not always right. It's not that they're wrong. You just have to be that person. And I remember her stopping the crying. And I remember her daughter just sitting there like my daughter was when we first were entering, just hundreds of wires just connected, and just this fear. You could just feel, you could smell the fear and just the sadness in the room. I ended up seeing her a couple years afterwards. We were up, and the girls were getting blood transfusions.
Did she recognize you?
She did. Yeah, and she thanked me for what I had said and how much I changed that moment, that first day. And I knew that there was meaning in everything that was happening.
You never know. In the moment, I'm not sure how long that took you.
Yeah.
Maybe initially seemed like it could be an eternity, but probably a small amount of time that changed probably their trajectory if they took just a little ounce of your advice. So just reaching out with kindness and a positive intent.
Mm-hmm.
That ripple effect of probably not only changing their lives, but who in their lives is it changing, and then changing, and then changing by taking that little bit of time to care.
Mm-hmm. It is. And I mean, I can't say that there weren't bad days, fearful days, those days I couldn't barely get up off the floor. My daughter had those bad days, and I was able to uplift her, but I can honestly say that she was my warrior, because those days when I had bad days. I remember one day I had to pull the sheet around, and I remember just sobbing behind the curtain. And I hear this, "You're not supposed to be crying, Mom. We don't cry in here." And I was like, wow, she's amazing. And from that moment on, I think something changed in her. Like, it was huge in the beginning. There was a lot of fear for her. There was a lot of sadness, a lot of anger. But something happened to her that allowed her, you'll see in my book, these smiles, this positivity, this radiance that you just wouldn't expect from a 4-year-old to uplift her mother, to just be like, okay, I had that moment. I'm good. I'm good. No more tears. We're good. We're going to be warriors. We are going to shed light on everybody and just allow everybody to know that there is hope through this. And she was a huge part of my positivity and radiance.
Sometimes I think now don't tell my children this, but the innocence and purity of kids,
yeah,
they're so smart and sometimes smarter and stronger than us.
Mm-hmm.
And so to strip away what society and life has hardened us with in the walls that we put up, the yeah. kids can come in
mm-hmm.
and bring us back to what's really important.
Yeah. Yeah, and my family did the same. You know, my husband and my son would come up as much as they could and bring us dinner. They couldn't understand exactly what was happening, but there was always laughter and just trying to change that perspective. I mean, I remember my son, even, you know, at 6 years old, just always just giving her, you know, just jokes and what happened during the day and just bringing some sort of joy to her. I mean, it was very, very tough for him as well.
We have friends who their son is a junior like my son in high school, and brain cancer in kindergarten was diagnosed. And I really hadn't thought about it then, but there was a lot of focus with friends of kids with cancer and things mm-hmm. on the sibling.
Yeah.
It's really, really hard on that sibling for many reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And often because of the focus on the child's yeah. health that needs it, they may feel lost.
Yeah. And there's a lot of guilt on my part. I just recently allowed myself to release the guilt that I felt for not being with him for probably 3 years and what I missed. And I think that if we allow ourselves to just give yourself grace, give yourself that ability, we're not perfect. Just break down those walls and stop feeling so guilty. It will help. You know, in the last 9 years, I've talked to a lot of families that guilt was one of their biggest hurdles of just not being able to get over what they felt, how they weren't there. But sometimes it was just something that we felt and it wasn't actually real. And so I think just making sure that we know how important we are and how valued we are in those situations. There's nobody putting any timelines or restraints on us. We put it on ourselves. We want to do better. But I remember one day with my son looking in his backpack many years later and just going through the backpack and finding a picture of my daughter in his backpack. And I remember asking him what the picture was for, and that I didn't know that picture was there. And he said, "Mom, I carried it every single day in my backpack just so I could see her." It was, I can't even tell you how it made me feel, but there were those little things that I didn't know about, and I didn't know what he was feeling. And just to know that he thought of his sister every single day and had this just adorable little photo of her before she was sick. And then I spoke with teachers and they said, yeah, he had that picture in his backpack in a folder that he opened up in every class every single day so he could see her.
So that fear when he was born of what mom you were gonna be, I hope you can look at that and say, oh, I did a lot right.
I hope. Yeah. I just didn't want the guilt of feeling as though I had abandoned him for something else. But I think it made him stronger. It made him realize what family means and the love. And there's going to be challenges always. How are you going to persevere through them? What are you going to do? How will you lift yourself up? How will you get through it? And what does that look like? And I was sad that I didn't know that he carried that photo. But I was very glad when I finally knew that that's what had happened. And I think just trying to compartmentalize those feelings of I wasn't there, but he didn't hold me guilty of that. I was holding myself with a lot of that guilt.
It's a lot of, I think sometimes the struggles that we do go through in life is what we say or tell is going on internally and externally versus maybe what's really going on.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, you know, I'm not just saying that males don't do that, but I think females, I mean, I think women do that. I think we really hold a lot inside, and I think we hold that guilt and that fear, and we need to be more, and just that value and wanting to find joy and not knowing. And it truly is just something that I'm so passionate about now, because I'm so glad that I found every bit of that within myself. And I now, kind of after these experiences, have a chance to write this book and create what I'm creating, because I couldn't have created it without going through the experiences that I went through.
Well, I think that's a great point to jump to the book and jump to the things that have, that you're now using in a positive way to help others. But obviously, spoiler alert, she's here.
Yeah.
Things, as well as they could have, or through the advocacy and the fight and the familyness. She's 13.
She is. She's 13. We don't have the opportunity to offload, you know, what she could go through in the future. You know, we're optimistic. We changed everything from her diet to our thought processes, our patterns, our behavior, everything that we know that the body can either create a negative situation or a positive situation, because what you think is probably what's going to happen to you. And we see those clinical trials, and there are very few of them. This genetic gene, it's unfortunate but fortunate, because it doesn't make money, and so it's not studied. It's kind of thrown in the trash. So there was only one clinical trial. It does diagnose two additional cancers at very pivotal ages. And so I think a lot of my fear was stormed by, I couldn't even get through the first one. How am I going to gear up and get through the next couple of cancers? I don't know how to do this. And that then started a spiral that, like you said earlier, made me extremely sick, and to the point where I didn't know if I could go on. But yet, we don't get the luxury of offloading this burden and what we're going to do. But I realized I do get the opportunity to look back through all of our years through different lenses and see things through a different perspective and see such positivity in what we've been through and what we can do and ignite and kind of light things on fire, because she's going to be a warrior. And she has more opportunity than she even knows. And I want her to know kind of what it looks like for her in her future. And don't hold these stories inside. And don't hide those scars, because they are absolutely beautiful. And they are truly who she is. And people need to see it. They need to hear it. And we just need to talk about it more, because it's powerful.
Yeah, we need to let those walls down that we think are protecting us. In fact, they aren't protecting us. They're probably harming us in the long run.
Yeah.
And we're being maybe a little bit selfish of who are the people that need to hear our story, need to hear what we went through, so that they can see hope and light related to what they might go through. And I mean, what would your advice be for anybody who is going through it, or might come across cancer or something like that in the future?
Yeah, I think, you know, the best advice I can give is go your own way. Just go your own way, be your own person, take everything with a grain of salt, but trust your instincts and your gut feelings of what you feel. But you also really need to lean into your family and just make sure that you're all on the same page. Because if you're not, I see where that 90% divorce is 100% possible. And I think that you don't allow yourself to bring your family together in those kind of situations, because you can become isolated and completely fearful and scared. And one person lives at the hospital and one person lives at home, and you're trying to juggle jobs and family and marriage, and you didn't feel what I felt, and I can't believe you weren't there, and things really start unraveling. And so I think that if you can go your own way, bring your family together, keep them together, keep consistent communication, but keep optimistic and positive, because there are miracles and stories out there that happen every single day, and it can certainly happen.
Well, all of that, I'm going to lead into this in a very awful way. It's a lot of gray and a lot of darkness. So leading to out of the gray and into the light, the book comes.
Yeah.
Again, sort of by accident, you said.
Yeah.
How does this evolve, and what is the book bringing us? And what are you doing? A lot of questions, but I think there's going to be a lot of light to end this story. And I think it starts with that book.
Yeah, so the story really came from a point of almost self-destruction of myself. You know, we had come through the cancer. We were in remission with our daughter. But like I told you earlier, there was something that always just burning. And it led through, and it bled through this situation, even more powerful of, now this has happened to our family. There had to be something more. And I think with me, I didn't handle and deal with the situation of what my daughter went through and what our family went through. We were going on autopilot and so fast that we really didn't do the self-care for ourselves that we needed. We didn't dig into what was happening. We just kind of brushed it under the rug and we all went on. We didn't dive into what my husband was dealing with through all of this. I mean, we went to counseling. Don't get me wrong. We did a lot of counseling. We did several different types of counseling, but the resources weren't there. We weren't given an opportunity to have any type of community that could just understand what we were going through and be able to give us what each of us needed. And I think that a lot of people feel that way going through this. You're on this situation where you don't know what to expect. And I'm sorry, if you don't have the finances for one of them or both of them to quit their jobs and completely put your 100% into what's going on, we go on every single day on autopilot, trying to just work, figure it out, pay the bills. There are things that just slip through the cracks. And unfortunately, I let very important things slip through the cracks of my own well-being, my own needs, my own self-care, and just dealing with what I went through. And I wasn't happy. I wasn't finding joy. There was something that was just completely missing. That trauma affected me in ways that I didn't know. And I didn't know how to deal with it. And so I'm not a very good listener sometimes. And I think for me, I wasn't paying attention to what was happening, what God was trying to tell me. Like, I keep nudging you. You're just not listening. This happened in your life. It's not for you to push under the rug. There's a lot of meaning behind this. You're just not seeing what your purpose was, what your why is. What am I wanting? What do I want? Like, I just wasn't paying attention to the voices that were occurring. And so I ended up literally just crying more than I ever did when my daughter went through all of her diagnosis and through being in the hospital. And I remember breaking down one morning and dropping her off to school. She goes to a Christian academy in St. Louis, and my car just kind of drove itself up to the parking lot above, and it's our church. And I remember walking in and crying for about 3 hours and just surrendering everything that I had, let my walls down. The surrender was there, asking what I needed to do. I couldn't keep up this pace. I couldn't continue what I was doing. I couldn't find joy. I couldn't find happiness. But yet, you'd look at me and I was at the top of my game with my company. Once again, President's Club, Rookie of the Year, awards. Something really immense was missing in my life. And God had just brought me to this point where I needed to do something about it. And I remembered like I said, not being able to sleep or eat or function because those videos just played in my head and memories that I couldn't remember before had occurred. And I felt that God was just calling me to something different, and I needed to lean into this uncomfort. And I think that God knew that I would, and I did. And that's kind of how everything came around. It was the fall of 2022. And then in the spring of 2023, I began writing the book. And that's where it all unfolded.
And is the book about your story, about everything we talked about, but then coming through it and what you've learned? And again, sharing for others how to find hope, joy, all of that, that you know, and I think a lot of us have been there. On the outside, yeah. It looks like everything's great. It should be, which mm-hmm. makes the internal feelings even worse. Like, yes. Why am I feeling this mm-hmm. bad? Why am I feeling it must be me? I'm even worse than I thought. Mm-hmm. Is that what this book is bringing to everybody?
It is. I remember journaling about 75 to 100 pages while I was in the hospital of just what was happening. Because one, I had to keep track. I couldn't remember. We couldn't remember medications. I couldn't remember things. Like, I literally felt like I was losing my mind. And so I did journal a lot. And so when the book came about, it was being able to look back and giving myself that ability to look back in a different perspective. See things how I saw it then, but see things how I saw it now. And how I had the ability to not control a lot then, but I could control how I saw everything and my perspective of what it looked like now. I could change all the fear and the anger and the feelings that I felt now if I would just look at it in a different perspective and see things in a different way. God wasn't taking us there to dump us in this place of fear and sorrow and hurt. Was taking us to this place that was just going to be so beautiful that I wasn't realizing what was happening. So the book then takes you back, you know, 9 years. And the actual title was going to be Her Perfect Storm. It was the perfect storm that occurred in our daughter because her rare cancer gene actually is never supposed to happen. It starts with the parents. It doesn't start with the individual. So it's this perfect storm that started in her, and it was a perfect storm that started in myself that just brewed and brewed until I was allowed to just surrender everything and be able to give myself grace and the forgiveness that I really needed. And it is. It's all about advocacy, advocating for yourself, for others, but it's being able to find hope in what you're going through, the deepest, the darkest times. There is hope because you're not dumped there and you're not left. You are there with arms wrapped around you and the ability to pick yourself up and make something great if you're willing to see what it is.
So it's obviously the story where cancer is involved, but it sounds like it's surviving,
yeah,
coming through that, reflecting back on what is it for anybody going through something traumatic or having that lost, yeah, dark feeling inside themselves, what can they learn? What have you learned from your experience and what might help others?
Yeah, I think just talking about it, communicating, telling your story. I want more people to tell their story. I journaled it. Like I said, I carry my journal everywhere. It's just being able to either talk about it. I would carry around my phone and do just an audio recording all the time and then listen to it again and again and journal it. And the book was bittersweet for me. It was extremely healing. And I think for anyone going through something like this, they need to get it out. And the more individuals that I've met that have actually written books that have gone through this are the ones that are thriving because they wrote it down. They dealt with it. They told their story. They weren't ashamed to tell their story. They told it to the world every single day. They weren't going to bow down to people bullying them that they needed to stop telling this amazing story because it's going to help people. We don't need to hide everything because that won't help. It will only help the people that don't want to see it. We cannot do that. And so I think if we will share our stories and be able to enjoy that ability to find hope and encouragement, that's where it is. But my next move is really creating, and I've started creating this community. I created an advocacy and hope group on Facebook, and it's really kind of evolved into this big community of individuals that need this community of things that I didn't have. I needed assistance with, how are we going to financially be able to do this? What does this look like? No one's there giving you any type of help, helping you out of it, saying, here, we'll give you, you know, your finances and be able to pay your insurance and your money. Read the book, because once again, the floor just kept falling out over and over and over again. And everything that I thought was so important to me, I lost. And then realizing a lot of those things were not important, and realizing what was most important. But the finances is huge, because everybody I've interviewed over the last year that have been through a situation like this with their child, finances was number one that trickled down and affected everything else within the family. How are we going to do it? And it caused just complete separation within the families. And it's sad. It's so sad to say that money does that, and that there's more now. I think once we look at resources, we can find it, but I'm building that community to be able to help these families with that. But also, if we're not healthy in our mind and our mind frame isn't healthy, we're not going to be able to make it. So being able to give ourselves grace and that forgiveness and be able to just do some self-care is really important. But also, where's their faith? You know, what does that look like? Because I can honestly say, if we didn't have faith through all of that, we wouldn't be here today. And I don't know how people make it. And maybe that's where the 90% lies. Maybe they didn't have faith and lost it and just didn't feel they could make it. So I want to create all of those things that these families need that I didn't find. And if we can all just join together to give that encouragement and community and safe space, that's where we're going to find fulfillment.
And that's what I love about coming out to this side of it, is I think, you know, the story underlying it all is the health issues and dealing with that. But the learning is really about the mindset, advocacy, yeah, boundaries, communication, mm-hmm, you know, everything you need to be successful in life, whether or not it's a... Yeah. traumatic situation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You don't want to wait until it happens. We all prepare for certain things. We hope that we prepare for death. We hope we kind of set up those trusts and those wills and things we're told to do, you know, check these off our checklist. But what else? When those challenges land on your doorstep, what are you going to do? How are you going to not be that 90% statistic? I want to be, and I think that I pushed so hard through the last 9 years to be in that 10% that maybe I lost myself. And I think that that's where, kind of moving forward, I'm in the process of writing a second book. It's where I felt that I needed to be in that 10%, but maybe it gave me something to just stay there and be really determined. But I want to know that 90% so much more. And that's kind of my dedication now. What happened? And don't wait until those challenges and difficult situations land on your doorstep, because they will. And how will you step up, and how will you prepare for them early? And I bet you it's just going to change the entire trajectory of your entire life.
Wow. A second book. A really smart person told me once that writing a book is not for sissies. And here you are going into a second one.
Yeah.
But the advocacy and hope is more, and there's the financial aspect of it, but there's more of those who, if you feel lost, finding yourself, yeah, finding your potential, having the hope and the belief in building the person you know you can be, mm-hmm, the person you want to be.
Yeah.
So a lot of the foundation of where you got to today is around the illness. But what you're giving back is so much more. So it's only for me if I went through something similar. It is about building that better person, that better life, mm-hmm, through advocacy, hope, mindset, all the things that go with it.
Yeah, it is. There's a lot of threads in the book. And I think that, you know, that first conversation with that gentleman in the coffee room in the hospital will allow anyone to think someone else is always going to have something worse, you know? So I get it, but just be humble about what you're going through, because there's always somebody out there that has something worse. You know, give back each day, you know, try to do something that gives you that feeling of gratitude. And just know that, you know, you can move this movement forward, but being in that positive mind frame is huge. But I also think we changed our routine, our morning routine. You know, my husband and I are very grateful in the mornings. We're very grateful through the days. But just that, just starting your day being extremely grateful, because I had to do that in the hospital, because it like I said, it wasn't for sissies. And you wake up at four in the morning and you have 20 some residents standing in your room every single morning talking at you like you're a research project. They don't talk to you. They talk at you. And they're just in your room. They don't knock. They come in. So you better be presentable, because they're... It's just one of those things that you just need to take a step back and just think about. But the book will really resonate with a lot of people that are going through anything difficult, or, you know, maybe they just want to read a great book on how to be an advocate for others, because I think we're losing that in today's society. Stand up for yourself and stand up for others. Don't let that opportunity pass you by. It could change your life, and it will definitely change theirs.
That's a great way to summarize a lot. I mean, I think, you know, while you're successful in medical sales and so much, that we're here today for the book. We're here today for what the messaging can give to others who need to hear it. And so if there's anybody who needs her for medical sales, you can find her. But what we're here for is really the book, where to find it, mm-hmm. your community that you're building, how to tap into that, find it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the book is Out of the Gray into the Light. It was just launched. It will ship tomorrow. And if you want to learn a little bit more about me, you can go to my website at amypost.com. And that's AmyPost.com. You can read the first chapter. You can order the book there. It's available in all the major retailers. Amazon is one of the main. But pick up a copy for yourself and a friend. And I really want you to just read it with somebody important, somebody that maybe is going through something, or somebody you just really care about, and talk about things that you see in it and the threads that you're finding. And I think just finding that bonding moment and those times together to read a book that just hopefully pulls at your heartstrings and allows you to be you, allows you to just flush it all out and not feel bad about telling your story and being yourself and standing up for yourself and others. And that's what I really want for this book. And it's come a long way from the moment that I first wrote it, because it was honestly, I just wanted, if I helped one person, it was great. If I healed my heart, that was great. That's all I needed. And now I just can't stop, because it's not about me any longer. It's about everybody else that's going through things that I never want anyone to feel the way that I felt. And I know there's so many out there that do. And I need them to know there's a safe place and a community and people that really want you there. Because I could tell you, who you hang around with is who you are. Who you surround yourself with, who you, in these times of trauma, if you just isolate yourself, it's very sad. It's very lonely. There are places here in this community that I'm creating that want these people to come and will literally just welcome them with open arms and offer so much opportunity for them. I am in the process of partnering with Make-A-Wish. Of course, my daughter is a Make-A-Wish patient, but they have been wonderful. We are getting ready for lots of wonderful events coming up. Also, Joy FM, if you are a local, you can get it as well on an app, but they are a great radio station that serves so much of Missouri and Southern Illinois, but just spreads hope and joy. and any other organizations that would like to partner. That's what we're here to do, to just bring this community together and just let these people know, anybody out there, that they're not alone and they are worth it.
Realness, humanness, hope, love, and joy.
Yeah.
So to find the book, go to your website, anywhere selling books, look for Advocacy and Hope, the new community that you're building, and, you know, become a part of it, partake, and see where your ripple could take us all.
Yes, absolutely. And I can't wait to hear all those ripples from so many people out there that didn't think they were good enough or couldn't do it, weren't courageous, and they weren't confident. I want to hear those. I want to see those ripples.
That's fantastic. I think it's a great place to wrap my portion of this up. And I thank you for sharing. I should have prepared, but I don't know that I was ready to tear up like I did. But again, your openness and vulnerableness was so appreciated. So I want to thank you again for sharing everything with us today. Excited to see where the book goes. And another amazing and going into the uncomfortable, doing a live session on remote location. So thanks for allowing us to be a part of your story.
Cynthia, thank you. I appreciate you and I appreciate your time and everyone here. Truly do. I am blessed.
This concludes another episode of the She Lift Project podcast. To hear more episodes of the show, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And to learn more about our mission of helping women reach higher levels of success, visit SheLiftProject.com and sign up to receive the latest news, ebooks, videos, and more.